lunatics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I am joined by the professor of law at Chase Law School, Ken Katkin. Ken, welcome to the last Politics Guys of 2023.
It's hard to believe.
You know, it was weird. I was getting things set up. I'm teaching a winter session class, and so the end of it's going into 2024. I don't know about you, but 2024 and 2025 feel like they must, in fact, be the distant future. You know, it can't, you know, next year can't be 2024, and the year after that cannot be 2025. And, you know, that's something like, you know, I don't know. It'd be like Donald Duck blasting into space kind of future or something. I don't know. It just can't be next year. Is this a part of what just being 40 is? I mean, I know you've been there, Ken. So is this the inevitable result of all of that?
Yeah, I do think so. I think when I was your age, I experienced the passage of time kind of the way you're describing it. Like, it just seemed impossible that I could be living to be go that far into the future. You know, now that I'm an old man, I look at every year as, all right, I'm one step closer to retirement.
See, I love it. So I do want to let our listeners know, and I'll remind us at the end as well, that this is our last weekend show. So Ken and I, we will, as always, be having our supporters show next week. But this is our last weekend show. And then actually I take that back actually, because we'll have one last 2023, because Mike and Jay will resume the weekend show on December 30th. So they'll get one just in. I was looking at my calendar. Yeah. So they'll get one just in at the end of 2023. This is the last for us though, Ken. And we'll move from there. We do this every year. And so just a heads up on that front, that we will be taking that Christmas week off as we always do. So, before we get to the break, though, well, kind of like Congress, you got to get the last few things done and in, right? And so what better segue than to talk about the defense bill this week getting passed? As a matter of fact, early on Thursday, the House passed its annual bill, sending the $886 billion in spending to the president. Now, that National Defense Authorization Act, or as you're oftentimes going to see it in the news, the NDAA, includes some pretty key items: a 5.2% pay raise for troops, funding Ukraine, although not the additional levels of funding that Biden was asking for, and the continuation of a pretty controversial foreign surveillance program. And it got passed despite there being a lot of House Republicans who were against its passage. And they really kind of were into two camps. You had one group of Republicans who were against it because they did not want the $886 billion. They did not like that number. Then you had another camp of Republicans and a few Democrats, although it didn't change their votes. There were a few other Republicans, though, who did not like the extension of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And what that does is enables the United States to monitor foreign nationals using U.S.-based messaging services without a warrant. So really, like I said, the rest of the lack of the support was a variety of amendments that the House version of the bill had originally had, primarily dealing with immigration, but a variety of other sundry things. That just did not have the support in the Senate to move forward. But it does get passed. It does get passed and on the president's desk before Christmas. So, you know, Ken, what I kind of thought we would do is, one, kind of talk about what the spending bill itself means moving forward for the broader set of spending packages that have to happen. This is the first one. And then also some of your thoughts more specifically on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, because that's one of the ones that, I'll be honest, gives me some heartburn. But I thought we'd talk about that second.
Sure. So you want to know my thoughts on the bottom line number?
Let's talk about the fact that it got passed and its number. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think it's basically good that it got passed. I guess one thing that it's an interesting additional example of that we've been seeing more and more is that it's not actually possible for the House to pass any bill at all without some Democratic votes. And so that actually is giving the Democrats a bit more influence on what comes out of the House than they would otherwise have, because there's no bill coming out of the House without at least a few Democratic votes. And I think that did mean that, you know, some of the hard rights priorities, which were mostly on kind of social policy issues, buried into the defense bill, stuff like no drag shows on military bases and things like that. That stuff all had passed the House the first time around, but it all got stripped out in order to get the bill through. I think it doesn't contain nearly enough money for Ukraine. I think there is something like $800 million in there for Ukraine, and the Pentagon's request had been in the tens of billions. So it's, you know, less than a tenth of a penny on the dollar from what was requested, and I think that is problematic. But I think sort of blocking military aid for Ukraine was the main thing that the far right managed to accomplish. And other than that, I think you've got a, you know, reasonably good consensus defense bill. And it's good to see Congress functioning and actually get something enacted by very large majorities in both the Senate and the House in the end. In fact, in the House, it was by the necessary 2/3 vote, which was needed to get quickly past all the procedural obstacles that a minority could have thrown up, against a vote that where there was a majority to carry the bill. So I basically think it was a reasonably good day for Congress. The number, it's very hard for me to evaluate the top line number. I don't have that kind of expertise in, you know, do we need 886 million or do we only need 786 billion or 786 billion? I really don't know. I don't know what every penny is going towards, but I do have some faith that with such large bipartisan majorities for it in both houses, that there's less than the usual amount of fraud, waste, and abuse in there, I would think.
Yeah, I mean that's a hopeful thought. I'm always a little bit, you know, this is one of the areas where I probably don't align. You know, I'm always trying to be upfront with listeners. You know, one of the areas where I probably don't align, I'm not a particular hawkish individual. And so, you know, my defense spending would, I'm going to probably be even more of a fiscal conservative on military spending than other things. But, you know, I think you're right. It's going to be difficult to kind of parse some of that out. Now, one of the things I thought about on that number, and you had already started to zero in on it, was discussion of the funding for Ukraine, because, of course, that number, like I had mentioned, and then you reiterated, was far lower than what the defense agencies wanted for Ukraine. And as a matter of fact, earlier in the week, of course, Ukrainian President Zelensky was in Washington attempting to lobby for that. But this morning, Friday morning, Hungary actually ended up blocking $54 billion in European aid to the Ukraine. And so this really is going to be the money that they get. But I think this sets up maybe there's kind of two questions that's going along when we're thinking about the spending on this term. You know, I think there are some. Obviously, Hungary, Ukraine, that's a support for Russia in this hard stop period, right? I mean, I don't think there's a lot of discussion to be had said there. But I do think there is more broadly in Europe and emerging in the United States the question of how much and how long can we continue to spend for Ukraine and what we can do. In part for me, if you think about now at the beginning of that conflict, you know, none of us as hosts thought that Ukraine would hold out as long as they have. They continue to hold out. And the question is you know, what is the cost and how much can we do for that? You were talking there about, you know, it not hitting what Zelensky and other Defense Department members wanted. But I think this is going to continue to be a question, which is how much is the right amount to keep Ukraine moving forward, especially if it appears that Europe is going to be effectively blocked moving forward. What do you think about that, Ken?
Well, yeah, you're right. First of all, to remind me that I was very skeptical up front at the beginning that it would be possible for Ukraine to hold out. But I've kind of changed my views on that based on how well they have been doing. You know, it seems that their performance as a military has exceeded expectations to such an extreme degree that, you know, it makes me start thinking about things like, well, you know, Afghanistan managed to defeat the Soviet Union in a war. Afghanistan also managed to defeat the United States in a war. And Vietnam managed to defeat the United States in a war. So I think it's actually the David and Goliath story that you see. It's not as impossible as I was maybe first thinking about it, but it is absolutely impossible without Western support. And I think the investment is worth it for all kinds of reasons. I think Ukraine is a fledgling democracy at the heart of the former Soviet Union. It's basically in a location that is the wall between Russia and Europe. I think both Russia and China will be very encouraged in sort of continued military aggression against small neighbors. China's certainly been eyeballing Taiwan. If it seems like the Western democracies are, you know, going to put in, you know, kind of a token resistance and then fold up at a certain point. And I don't think that's good for the security of the world at all. I don't think that's good for democracy at all. You know, I think the reason we have alliances like NATO is to really try to maintain a world order where aggression like Putin's aggression in Ukraine against democracies will always be resisted, so that there's a very high deterrence against them doing it. And so I would grant every penny of the Biden administration's request, which, as I said, is more than 1,000 times the number of dollars that Congress actually allocated.
It's 100, but you had said that right first time. Just heads up.
It's 100 times. Okay, one cent on the dollar.
Yeah, I mean, again, you had said that the first time too, and you were correct.
Okay.
Anyway.
Okay.
I'm just making you consistent with yourself. When you're already right, I have to keep you right. That's all.
Thank you.
Now, I mean, I guess the last thing I'll say on that before we move to talk a little bit more about the foreign surveillance is, the only way you have those kinds of asymmetric but state to state. So one of the things for listeners when you're thinking about military conflicts, right, you can have asymmetric between a state and a non-state actor. But in this case, we have an asymmetric conflict between a state and another state actor. And those are different kinds of things because they both have territory. So in this kind of conflict, and so you're right, Ken. I think this is more attuned to what you were talking about in terms of, I think, especially Afghanistan, you know, the possibility of just holding out and holding out and holding out and holding out, which is, in fact, what Afghanistan was able to do against, well, then the Soviet Union in a past history. But of course, you're talking about a multi-set of year contract. So one of the things that had given me a little bit of pause that changed. I kind of was thinking about this and writing things up this week for it. But when it became apparent this morning that Europe has no more funding for Ukraine, I guess now it makes me pause and say, well, are we going to, I mean, even if the amount the Biden administration had asked for before was in part contingent on the continued support of Europe. But if Europe isn't going to have any support for Ukraine, are we able to fill both of those holes? And I don't have an answer to that question, but that was my big question mark was, how does that work moving forward? Of course, these things happen simultaneously, so nobody was thinking about it in those terms. But of course, as this comes forward, there is still going to be asking for funding for Ukraine. What do you think in that context of the fact that Europe is seemingly going to just be blockaded from being able to provide support moving forward because of support for Putin primarily?
Yeah, but it's not the same because, you know, if this was the United States, you know, if the United States wouldn't give aid, you know, then the state of Ohio or the state of Oklahoma can't just give aid. But that's not how it works in Europe. The European countries will still give plenty of military aid to Ukraine. It's just that the European Union as an institution won't give military aid to Ukraine. So certainly it's a significant problem that Hungary is able to block the EU from giving military aid. But Germany's still going to give military aid. France is still going to give military aid. I hope the UK is still going to give military aid. So it's not like Europe is completely cutting them off the way we sort of are.
Okay, so let's shift gears then and talk about the temporary extension of the foreign surveillance program. So just as a reminder for listeners, what this was, it's a little piece. It's not really dealing with funding, but it was one of the only writers that made it as part of the NDAA. And what that is it is a extension of the Section 702 portion of the Foreign Surveillance Act, which what it did was it allowed FBI agents primarily to use that to surveil non-U.S. citizens abroad for foreign intelligence purposes when they're having messages to individuals inside the United States. In other words, it's the United States side of a digital conversation that law enforcement can get and asks for. What makes it, of course, controversial is that it can all be done without a warrant. And so to date, searches for Americans' communication, including the use of protesters, racial justice activists, 19,000 unique donors to congressional campaigns, journalists, and even we now know some members of Congress. So effectively, this is kind of a punt of the status quo until April when it's going to come up again. This is one of those weird items, though, Ken, where you get both some individuals on kind of the right and the left coming together who don't like this, but the middle liking it. So what's your take on the foreign surveillance? I was sad to have it be part of it, although I didn't think since it was a punt until April that it warranted taking the whole bill down. But I would happily like to see this slide into the night forever.
Yeah, my views on that have changed recently as well, I guess. I would have been really 100% aligned with you for a lot of the history of the FISA. But I think because of the world situation right now, I actually think it's more relevant to have it than it has been in a while. And I'm really talking both about the wars in Ukraine and in Israel. And also the linkages between the American far right and foreign far right dictatorships. And I think that some of that stuff does have to be monitored. And so the FISA Section 702, it allows the U.S. intelligence services to put wiretaps on foreign nationals who are not located in the United States, but it would still allow that monitoring to happen even if they're talking to someone who's inside the United States. So I think that both the civil liberties objection and the argument that it's needed, relate around the fact that this is going to allow warrantless wiretapping of conversations between American citizens who are in the United States and foreign nationals who are outside the United States. But I think there's just much greater national security need for some of that kind of wiretapping right now than I can remember at any time over the past 20 years. And so I've also been a critic of FISA wiretapping, but I'm a little more seeing a little more need for it right now is what I would say.
I guess my problem with that, though, is, well, two. One, it is always an issue for me when you're not having a warrant, because the question becomes, why don't you think you can get the warrant? Right. Well, so if there's in fact good reason to think that this is necessary, take a judge.
Yeah, but it's national security surveillance. It's not criminal law enforcement surveillance. So there may be contact.
But, I mean, you're talking about the FBI in this case. I mean, obviously there is some domestic element to it. Otherwise, we'd only be talking about, say, like the CIA.
Well, right. I don't know that FISA is specific only to the FBI. Is that right?
FISA at least includes the FBI, and they are the ones who have been using it the most extensively. I know those two things. I can't answer the other question.
Yeah, I would have thought it would also have applied to the NSA and the CIA, and that it's just generally allowing for foreign intelligence wiretapping. And yeah, I take your point about the FBI. I mean, I probably would be willing to actually concede that part of it, that if it's the FBI doing the wiretapping, they should be doing it in a law enforcement capacity, and therefore they should not be doing it unless they have both probable cause and necessity. I think you're right about that.
Okay. Well, yeah, okay. I was a little surprised at first. I thought you were saying,
But I was thinking more of CIA and NSA wiretapping, and the CIA and NSA wiretapping is never going to be used in a law enforcement capacity, and it's just going to be used in an information gathering capacity. And I think if elements, say, of the American far right right now are, you know, actually, you know, in communication with Putin and Orban and people like that about how to use, you know, extra legal means to advance their agenda here and how they can get foreign support to do that. I think that that's something that our intelligence services actually need to be on top of. And similarly, like, you know, I think Hamas may even have been, you know, getting some communications with some people in the United States or in other parts of the world, because the FISA wiretapping also would allow wiretapping of phone calls between people in other countries and other people in different countries. And that's part of the 702 authority also. It's not always authorizing calls where one of the people is actually in the United States. And so I think that we need that kind of information in order for our intelligence agencies to be able to understand what's happening in the world and to head off threats. And that includes both threats to other countries as well as threats to the United States. So I just think it is necessary. But I do agree with you. It's not ever really necessary in a law enforcement capacity.
I mean, I hear that, but I'm being honest, it sounds so similar to the arguments that were made on the right during the Bush administration about those kind of circumstances. And I can't help, as a Latin American scholar, hear some of both left and right's use of those in their history as ways of effectively saying, well, we have to defend ourselves. But if the tools that we use to defend ourselves undo the very essence of what we are, have we really saved anything? I mean, that's probably a bigger question than we can take on just in the terms of foreign surveillance. Yeah. But so again, I'm not suggesting that there isn't a point that you have there. However, I am always going to be more skeptical of that kind of immediate need to say, well, in this day and age, the thing that we might not have done before, we just have to do it right now, because those things never seem to roll back. They become permanent parts of state action. And then they only ever seem to move in one direction primarily, right? And so I hear what you're saying. I mean, I get that. I mean, again, I think that was, in fact, I think the point of many in the Republican Party in the wake of 9/11 for increasing the amount of surveillance and NSA powers back then as well. And I was skeptical of it at that in that time as well.
Yeah, I mean, I share all those concerns, but I just think I apply them a little bit differently. So in terms of the essence of what we are, you know, I certainly agree with you that the essence of what we are, it's something that we should be trying to save, is a free country that's not a surveillance state where people aren't being continuously surveilled by the government the whole time. I certainly agree that's part of the essence of what we should be trying to save. I think on the other hand, you know, other things we're trying to save. We are an electoral democracy, for instance. We have elections. The winner of the election gets to take power. There was an actual Russian plot to help Trump interfere with that. And I think if that kind of plot had a foreign plot to essentially take over the United States through an American agent who wouldn't leave office even after he lost an election and who had a lot of foreign help in trying not to lose the election by, for instance, you know, all the disinformation that Russian bot farms sent out on social media and things like that, then, you know, if foreign countries can essentially defeat us by undermining our democracy, that's something we need to save ourselves against also. So I don't think there's a perfect Panglossian situation here where, you know, we get to be the real America if we just refrain from doing one thing, and we don't get to be the real America if we do it, because I think there's serious threats to Americanism. And then I think on the other part of what you said about things, you know, any kind of encroachment of authoritarianism, the more the American people will learn to live with certain aspects of authoritarianism, the more that never goes back in the other direction. You know, I don't know that that's entirely true. I mean, I think you can see examples of of kind of waxing and waning of different kinds of times of civil rights. You know, we had probably much greater protection of all kinds of civil rights in this country during the era of the Warren Court and its immediate aftermath in the 1950s and 60s and early 70s, that where the court was really protecting individual rights to a much higher level than it did before or since. And so, you know, I'm focusing on the before part here, that, you know, American protection for civil liberties really was much greater in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s than at any earlier time in American history. So we didn't, you know, we had a long history. For instance, when you talk about the FBI, you know, from when the FBI was created, you know, until the Warren Court started reining it in the 50s, they respected literally zero civil liberties ever. They violated the law exactly as they pleased all the time. And that got finally reined in decades later. So I don't think it's always a one-way street where encroachments against rights just always grow and grow and grow.
Well, I'll say that we probably need to maybe sort of pause there as we move forward. Not that that's not an important topic. We could have a whole show just on that. Yeah. But the other big item that we wanted to get to is kind of a two-part item, and it's a continuation in some ways of what Mike and Jay covered last week. So to set all of this up, this week, Republicans voted 221 to 212 to open an impeachment probe against Biden. And the investigation is to look at if Hunter Biden's foreign business dealings were used to help Biden. Specifically, they're looking at the actions of Hunter in Ukraine and in China. Now, the White House has dismissed the inquiry as unsubstantiated by any particular facts. Now, this goes along with also this week, Hunter Biden defied a subpoena to testify in private to Congress. And the reason he defied that subpoena was saying that he feared his words would be misrepresented. He went on to say, quote, "There is no evidence to support the allegations that my father was financially involved in my business because it did not happen," end quote. Now, Mike and Jay last week had looked a little bit at kind of the Hunter Biden dealings, and their bottom line takeaway was Hunter Biden is probably doing shady illegal things, and that therefore warrants some scrutiny. Jay was far more likely to say, look, there's no connections to Biden yet, but I think it warrants further investigation. Where Mike, on the other hand, was saying, look, this is bad, but there doesn't really appear to be anything at all that even suggests that we need to connect further with dealing with Biden. There's just not a lot to suggest that could even happen. So what I did was I thought, well, since we're going to have to cover this in terms of the impeachment vote and then Hunter Biden not testifying, I thought I'd look at it a little bit. And so for me, I had not looked deeply at the Hunter Biden stuff. He doesn't particularly interest me all the time, but I wanted to prepare for this. And so it kind of reminded me when we did the show on Justice Thomas, Ken.
Yeah.
Where I kind of thought, this is probably like a lot of right wing guys getting at him. And the more you look at Hunter Biden side of things, at least, man, the worse it really is. Like, I didn't realize quite how bad. So if you look at the evidence, and if listeners, if you want a really quick takeaway, if you want to do everything I did, you can actually go get some pretty cool summaries from PolitiFact. And so what you start to see is that during the 6 years where Hunter Biden was having some deep problems with drug abuse, he had some really close ties to Ukraine, Romania, China, and Kazakhstan. And in short, got about $25 million to Biden family and Biden family associates during that period, which doesn't appear that he really did anything for them other than he's a Biden, meaning that he's just kind of exploiting his last name. Of that $25 million, just shy of $5 million went directly to himself, that is Hunter Biden, to his brother, James Biden, to Haley Biden, and then to this unknown Biden account that we don't know who has links to. All of this gets sent through by wire services via a limited liability corporation owned by an associate of Hunter Biden before then heading in to the Biden family accounts. Now, of that $5 million, 89% of it is going directly to Hunter Biden. So, it's pretty clear. Hunter Biden has made a ton of money that absolutely another addict at this period in time would have made last name. He cashed it in, and then he tried to get around paying taxes and broke some laws along the way. Now, the next level of that then is to say, okay, you know, Republicans are then alleging, look, because of all of these of this, you've got to look at President Biden. Now, to this point, though, there's zero evidence that President Biden has been involved in all of this. But the Hunter Biden stuff, man, is just terrible and nasty. So kind of my takeaway seems to be this, Ken. I'm curious what you think about. I get that President Biden has allowed, and I get it. I'm a dad. I'm a father. I think he's let his fatherness overtake the importance of his office. It is way past time for him to clearly state Hunter Biden did terrible illegal things. He shouldn't have done those things. And I have, you know, that he's never supported those things. And while he does, in fact, support his son as a person and as his father, that is fundamentally different than supporting him in his business dealings or in his failing to testify and come before Congress, not dealing with the subpoena. Because I really think that his move on Wednesday saying, nope, I'm not going to testify, even though I legally have to, in the aftermath of all of these things that he's done, just makes the whole mess look worse. As a matter of fact, Axios is reporting that this Hunter strategy is causing the White House itself to be really upset. This isn't what he wanted to do, but they're not willing to talk with Biden about it because, according to inside sources, Biden's just not willing to talk about anything Hunter. He's just going to support Hunter Biden no matter what. So that's kind of my takeaway from this. What is your thought?
I'm glad we get to have one issue at least where we'll 100% disagree. So I think Joe Biden has done everything perfectly. I would think not only should he not say that Hunter did anything wrong, but
you mean
in fact,
like not paying his taxes?
Right. He should not say that. And in fact, the president should never say that about anybody who hasn't been convicted of anything. It's completely wrong for a person who's been charged but not convicted to have the president of the United States weigh in.
Well, but pause on that real fast. I mean, in this case, Hunter and his team never denied that he didn't pay the taxes. What's saying now is that even though he didn't pay his taxes, that he has now finished paying his taxes after the fact. So he never, like Hunter Biden's team has never denied that he tried to get out of paying taxes. They're just saying that now he's paid it back on that particular front.
No, they've pled not guilty to the crimes that he's charged with. And a lot of people get behind in paying taxes and hear from the IRS about it and then pay. And it's not typical to be charged with a crime in that kind of situation. He has, in fact, pled not guilty. And no official in the government should ever say that anyone is guilty of a crime if that person has pled not guilty to the crime. And in this case, it's far more likely that these criminal charges were brought because his name was Biden than because of anything that he did. I actually am unaware of IRS cases where the person is charged after they've already paid up everything. I'm literally unaware of any other case like that. And here you had originally this special counsel who was appointed by Donald Trump was actually ready to close up this case entirely on a very minor guilty plea on charges that didn't relate to these taxes. And then it was only because of a huge amount of blowback from the House Republicans, because this was Hunter Biden, that the Trump appointed U.S. attorney asked to be designated as a special counsel and reopen this case. But I think there's completely nothing to these charges at all. You know, if every fact you said is true, there's still nothing to these charges, that a person who didn't report taxes got called out on that by the IRS and then refiled and paid them. You know, that's not commonly criminally charged. And then the other issue about I think the firearm charge was the one that he was going to plead guilty to before, and they weren't going to bring any tax charges. And then only because because Weiss had to go in front of the House Judiciary Committee, and they read in the Riot Act about not charging this tax stuff. I think that's only been charged in the last month, since the original plea deal would not have involved any tax charges whatsoever.
Okay, so Ken, as we look at this, what we're seeing is that he, according to the DOJ, he doesn't pay taxes in 2016, he doesn't pay taxes in 2017, he doesn't pay his back taxes in 2017, he doesn't pay his taxes again in 2018, doesn't pay his back taxes in 2018 again. For 2018, he gets a tax evasion charge. He then gets a false return in 2018 for showing that he had paid when he had not paid. And then in 2018, he also gets a failure to not pay for 2018. And then again, a failure to not pay and filing a false return in 2019 for showing that he had paid even though he had not paid. So yeah, so then he doesn't get actually charged with those until the very beginning of 2023, it appears. So there's our timeline.
Right. Or a different way of stating that same timeline is he did not pay his taxes in those years between 2016 and 2020.
Well, and attempted to cover it up.
Yeah. But then he does pay it all in 2021. And after 2021, he's completely current in all his taxes, and he doesn't get charged with tax crimes until the middle of 2023, a year and a half later.
Right. I mean, again, in part for filing false returns to attempt to show that he had paid it when he had not paid it. So, I mean, yeah. I can understand why you might still be filing charges against somebody, because this is the guy who said, oh, I've got it all fixed. But twice had purposely filed documents to evade the fact that he owed taxes to make it look like he had paid. So, I mean, I get your point of the timeline, but we're still talking about an individual here who, because of his over and over and over again attempting to cover this up, I can imagine you're still going to file taxes in that sense, because you now have two instances of where he is attempting to make it look like he did when he didn't again.
Right. Well, I think the facts that are indisputable are that he didn't pay those taxes in those years. The question of why he waited until 2021 to pay all the taxes that he should have paid in 2016 through 2020.
And then filed things to make it look like he had in the past.
Yeah, but we have not heard his side of the story of that. He's pled not guilty. He's going to have to answer that in court. But, you're just only looking at the prosecutor's side of the story here. And I think most of it might be contestable, which is why he's pleading not guilty. Right. I think the only thing that are not contestable are the actual timelines of when he paid. But that includes the fact that he paid it all long before he was charged. But the question of what, you know, whether he intentionally evaded things, that's really a question of his knowledge, his state of knowledge and his state of mind and his motives. And those are kind of things that the prosecutors are going to have to prove and that he pled not guilty to.
I'm also thinking about this in terms as a political item, too. Right? I mean, you're absolutely true in some of the legal senses that I'm focusing on the prosecutorial side of things. But we're talking about the son of the president of the United States. And there, that is a political item in the same way that when we talked about the dealings of the Trump Corporation and Trump's family is worthy of scrutiny and investigation, even if it is non-judicial.
Yeah, but, you know, again, you sort of focused earlier on the number 25 million. You said he sort of made $25 million out of the fact that his father was the president and he was named Biden.
And to be clear, he did not personally. So $25 million total to a bunch of individuals. He personally was getting about $5 million. Right.
Yeah.
So to be clear,
So we're talking about like 1% of the number that Jared Kushner made off of being the president's son-in-law. He made more than $2 billion off of that with this fund that he raised from the Saudis. And I don't raise that point to say that therefore they should be investigating Jared Kushner, but I rather raise that point to say that's actually the way it normally works with all presidents, I think it was more extreme in the case of the Trump kids than in other kids, and that Hunter Biden's, you know, the level that he profited off his connections to the president was probably fairly average for most people who are closely related to a president. But that's not itself a crime, and he's not actually being charged with that, right? So he is being charged with being late to pay his taxes, but he's not even being charged with anything related to, you know, how did you make this money? Because it's not a crime for someone who is a celebrity of one sort or another to monetize their celebrity.
So what is your opinion then on his decision on Wednesday to defy the congressional subpoena?
Yeah, I'm 100% on his side because he didn't defy it. He said he would answer all their questions under oath as long as it was in public.
But that's not how subpoena works. Like, Congress is to determine that. Like, Congress gets to issue a subpoena. They get to decide if you're in public or not in public. And there's nothing in the congressional's common law that says that they have to abide by your decision of whether it's going to be public or private. Where is that coming from, Ken? Come on.
Well, because they can vote him in contempt of Congress if they want to. But
well,
I think
of course, and they should.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think they probably will. I don't know if I think they shouldn't, but not. I think they could. I'll put it that way. I think
they definitely should. They definitely should.
No, because he didn't refuse to appear before them. Listen.
If you're saying if you have the power to subpoena and you have the power to subpoena the way you want, the other person doesn't get to say, oh, well, I'm not going to accept the subpoena unless it's under my terms. I mean, that's the same thing that the Trump guys did, and that was BS. Then and it's BS now.
It's not the same thing that the Trump guys did. So these guys like Peter Navarro and Steve Bannon and also Mark Meadows for that matter and Jim Jordan, they refused to testify in public or in private. They didn't just insist on testifying in public. I would not have voted to hold them in contempt if they had said, I'll testify, but I just won't testify behind closed doors. I want to testify out in public. If any one of those Trump guys had made that offer, I would not have advocated voting them in contempt because there's no legitimate reason that this is a political proceeding and there's no reason it should take place behind closed doors.
I mean, again, we have all kinds of closed doors members of Congress. I mean, we could have a conversation about whether we should have the ability to have closed doors congressional meetings, but we do. So I don't know how you separate those two. I mean, we could have an abstract conversation and say, look, should Congress be allowed to do this? And I'd be up for having that conversation. But since we grant that Congress can do it and we grant that Congress has a subpoena power, I just don't see how then the person who gets the subpoena gets to say, hey, in this case, it doesn't count because I would disagree in this one. I would vote to find him in contempt of Congress.
Well, I mean, if the argument you're making is that he has a legal obligation to testify because they subpoenaed him, that's correct. But if you carry that argument all the way out, well, then, what does the law say happens if he doesn't show up? Well, they have a legal right to vote him in contempt. So fine, they're going to do that. And then what happens next? Well, the Justice Department gets to decide whether they're going to prosecute him for contempt of Congress. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And even with those Trump guys, they prosecuted Navarro and Bannon. They did not prosecute Meadows or Jordan. So it's not an automatic no-brainer that if Congress votes somebody in contempt, that's going to be followed up by a criminal prosecution. I would think in this case it wouldn't. And so, to the same extent.
But now let's move it to the political side. Because again, in this case, this is one where we're similar, right? Like, I mean, I'm a guy who voted for Biden. This is a close election that apparently Biden is a little behind in right now when you take a look at the polls. Still too early to kind of really say. This hurts him. I mean, like, I don't see how this doesn't hurt him in major ways. And I don't say that as – I mean, I'm not taking this as like, yay, I want it to hurt him. I say this in terms of like, I'm reading the political lead. This is what I do. This hurts. And I don't get – it doesn't appear that there's any benefit to saying – I mean – he might as well go in and not defy the subpoena, not have to have the DOJ, because you're right. And they're going to vote to I think rightfully, they're going to vote to, and it's going to help Trump. It is going to help Trump.
Well, I'll agree with you halfway. This whole episode is going to hurt Biden and help Trump. What I don't agree with is that it's really clear whether going through with a prosecution for if the Biden administration goes through with a prosecution for contempt of Congress.
Well, whether they do or they don't, it's going to be terrible. My point is it's going to go to the DOJ. I agree with you on that front. But my point is once the DOJ has it, it doesn't matter what they do. If they prosecute it, it's going to hurt Biden. If they don't prosecute it, it's going to look like he doesn't want it to happen, even though there is, in fact, a wall there, and it's going to hurt Biden.
I agree with all that, but I think the logic of that implies that it won't get prosecuted because there's no good reason to prosecute it, and he's going to have to take the political punch from this no matter what he does. So I think it just ends there. I wonder why they don't prosecute Jim Jordan. Jim Jordan is the one who issued this subpoena. Jim Jordan himself is not in compliance with a subpoena and against him, and there was a vote of contempt of Congress against Jim Jordan by the House of Representatives, and he hasn't been prosecuted. And I think that if they end up deciding to prosecute Hunter Biden, they should bring down an indictment against Jim Jordan the same day. And I don't think that will happen, but I think there's definitely no more justification for a prosecution of Hunter Biden for resisting this subpoena than for one of Jim Jordan, because Hunter Biden, unlike all these other people, did agree to testify in front of the very committee that subpoenaed him as long as it was in public so that his testimony would not be distorted and misrepresented by people who are only doing this for political purposes anyhow.
Probably one of the biggest things that we've disagreed about in a while. I mean, even when we disagree, though, we disagree weird. I don't know. So, but we'll leave Hunter Biden behind, and we'll move forward to talking a little bit about some updates that have been happening in terms of Israel and Gaza, and potentially really kind of a potential growing rift between Biden and Israel. So, to kick this off, in a meeting on Thursday, Israel's defense minister told National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan that the war in Gaza may take months. And I know that's not what the White House was hoping for. This comes after Joe Biden took out some of his harshest words for the actions of Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israel, arguing that, quote, indiscriminate bombing, end quote, of Gaza was costing its support both internationally and implied, meaning the United States. Meanwhile, domestically, the left has continued to put more pressure on Biden to support Palestinians and to pull back some of its support for Israel. As a matter of fact, this past week, one area where this has really kind of come to the head is the growing rift in Senator Fetterman from progressives. Although, of course, in his case, it's a two-front rift, both with Israel. He has been a kind of a strong supporter. And though, of course, he has a desire, he agrees with Republicans on curtailing migration and immigration in the United States. So much so that this week, Fetterman said, I'm not a progressive. And I think that's kind of what a lot of progressives have been thinking in terms of Biden. As a matter of fact, Bernie Sanders, all of his campaign staff has signed an open letter. Elizabeth Warren's campaign staff signed an open letter a couple of weeks ago now, universally calling for Democrats and specifically President Biden to stop supporting Israel and to start supporting Palestinians and to realize that Palestinians are really the ones who are suffering here. And so I think one of the big questions becomes, you know, what is not only what Israel be doing as they move forward in terms of Gaza, which seems to be a continued attack, in their words, to get rid of this vast underground structure that Hamas has been using, but also pointing out that Hamas's support both in Gaza but now in other locations is really high, and therefore you can't stop fighting. And that seems to really run counter, I think, to a lot of the kind of growing consensus in the American Democratic Party, and I think in other Western European countries, that it's time for this to wrap up and be done at best, or perhaps evidence that Israel is in fact a colonial state at worst. And so what do you think about all of that, Ken?
Yeah, well, there's a lot there.
Just a little thing. It was easy.
Yeah. So the political problem that this war is causing Biden and the Democrats generally, it's serious, but my hope would be that it will blow over, before next November. But of course, that's going to depend on what happens in Israel over the next few months, and it's also going to.
And how many months is a few months when you're talking about this conflict? Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to depend on that, and it's going to depend also on how well Biden can reunify the party afterwards. You know, I hope and expect that, you know, his critics from the left, like Senator Sanders and Senator Warren and Congressman Tlaib and people like that, that there will be a certain point in time, sometime between now and November, where they will, re-endorse Biden and give their strong support to Biden and actually try to help Biden get elected. And I think if that kind of thing does happen, then what we're seeing right now is just a temporary blip, you know, that'll be, I think it can be overcome. I don't think it's an automatic problem that there's a rift right now over Israel and the Democrats, because that rift could be resolved. And what really matters is whether or not it's resolved. But there's a lot of contingencies there. I tend to think that Israel does need to continue to do basically what it's been doing. I don't think that there's much room for them to do much else. And so I think that if Biden, the more public he gets with, criticizing Israel, that's not going to necessarily help him either, because it's going to seem a bit ineffectual, right? The more if he, I think if he would call for an immediate ceasefire and then that immediate ceasefire wouldn't happen, then, I think that would make him seem ineffectual. So I think he's a bit constrained on both sides. He's constrained by what his left wants him to do, and he's constrained by what's within the world of possibility of what Israel might do. I do think he's been a somewhat effective, within the narrow constraints that he set out for himself of the U.S. did play a role in that 1 week-long humanitarian pause when there were still some hostage exchanges. And that probably wouldn't have happened without U.S. diplomacy. The U.S. has played an ongoing role in making it possible for some international aid to come in through Egypt, through the Rafah tunnel, which, again, I don't think Israel would have really done that except for the pressure from the U.S. So I think he's been, within limited grounds, somewhat successful at getting some limited forms of relief to the Palestinians. But I don't see that he can do that much more for them. And I don't know what people realistically think he can do.
I guess my last question on this, and then I think we may need to close the show, Ken, and this is what I really can't answer, because I'm not truly part of the left. Right? And that is, I have been wrestling, I've been talking about this on Discord, I can't quite understand, is it because of something in the nature of progressivism? Is it something about kind of the post-colonial view of many of Democratic parties? It's hard for me to understand this view of Israel as the colonial oppressor. It's hard. I always want to take the best position of my opponent. Like when we take on this show, I'm always trying to, when I think about this show, I always think about, like, okay, what would Ken's view be? And I don't think about, like, okay, and why is Ken wrong? I always try to think to myself, like, what would Ken say? What would be the best view for what would Ken be saying, right? And so I try to do that here as well. Like, right, okay, here are people who are very passionate, and I get that. I can't find the best positive for that. And I wonder if maybe it's because I'm not part of the left in that sense. Right. And so it bothers me a little bit because I can't figure it out. And so as I think about it, I just think, like, it just sounds dumb. Like I just don't understand, especially this past week when we were talking about so many people seemingly were supportive of, like, oh, well, they weren't really sexually assaulting some of the women who were held hostage. I'm like, what? Like, that doesn't count. Like, I just couldn't, it's okay if you're the oppressed to, like, sexually, I couldn't figure it out. So I guess for my last thing for the show, Ken, since you are part of the left. This rift in the Democratic Party baffles me because I can't understand the good intention. I can't understand it in a positive way. And so I don't know how to think of it. Does that make sense? My question?
It does make sense. I think I can address it. So I don't accept the narrative that Israel is a settler colonialist state. I think Israel is a completely legitimate state. In fact, it was born in probably the most legitimate way of any country on earth. It was created by the United Nations in a near unanimous vote as part of the dismantling of colonial empires in that part of the world. So I think very few countries have more claim to legitimacy than that. I think the United States is much more of a settler colonialist country in terms of the way, you know, we got founded by people who came over and killed the natives and took their land, and here we are. That seems to me much more egregious than anything that ever happened in Israel. But yet I will try to answer your question. I think the settler colonialist narrative, which I disagree with, sort of stems from a few things. It stems from the fact that that area in the centuries immediately preceding the state of Israel, the creation of the state of Israel, had been first part of the Ottoman Empire and then part of the British Empire. So it had, in fact, been colonialized by two recent colonial empires. And the British was the immediate one right before the state creation of the State of Israel. And with the British in particular, I think that narrative reflects the idea that the British involvement in Palestine did fit sort of the classical model of settler colonialism. British people came out there from Britain, just like they came here to the United States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand and India, you know, just to, you know, take land and extract resources and rule over it. You know, I think in the case of the British Palestine, they also had interest in it because of its relationship to the origins of Christianity and because of its strategic location in terms of, projecting the British Empire out into the Middle East. So there were a lot of reasons I think the British could fairly be accused of settler colonialism in the reasons that they had colonized British Palestine. I think the part that probably some of the people who continue this narrative would take, where I start to part ways with them, is there were always some Jewish people living there, and you know, in ancient history, of course, it was a Jewish kingdom, but the British also did encourage some Jewish emigration there, and the British encouraged this, you know, even as late as into the early 30s when anti-Semitism was taking hold in Central Europe. Britain was still, you know, saying, well, it would be good if Jewish people who wanted to leave Central Europe to escape anti-Semitism, if they didn't all come to England, but some of them would go to Palestine. And so there was probably a speeding up of emigration to Jewish emigration to Palestine during the late days of British Palestine. So I suppose from certain perspectives, you could look at this as, you know, the British came, and then the British encouraged other white people who weren't from the Middle East also to come. And then those people came and then they got land. Now, through that whole period, of course, the only way any Jews ever got land there was just by buying it in the ordinary way that any other immigrant would. And the Jews did own a fair amount of land in the parts of Israel that are inside the 1947 Green Line, you know, even before the UN declared that to be a new state of Israel. But I think the settler colonialist narrative starts with that idea that this all arises out of British imperialism. And then you have the British Balfour Declaration, which is the British government declaring that this could be in Israel, there could be a Jewish homeland. And then eventually of the United Nations, which is, you know, had all the countries in the world in it, but was dominated by the victorious powers in World War II, declaring that the state of Israel should be created. And so it wasn't that question wasn't put to the local people who live there. That question was put to the whole world community. So I suppose those are the arguments for settler colonialism. But, it leaves out a lot. I mean, it leaves out the fact that, for one thing, about half the Jews who live in Israel are what we would call Sephardic Jews, which means they are Middle Eastern Jews. They're not even Jews that came from Europe or anywhere else. So there's ethnically the Ashkenazi Jews and the Sephardic Jews, and most of the original founders of Israel were the Ashkenazi Jews from Western Europe. But now that's not even the case. So the Jews in Israel are mostly just as native to the land and it also ignores the fact that when Israel was created, every single Arab country in the Middle East expelled all the Jews. And we talked about this last time, that mm-hmm. Cairo at one point was one third Jewish, you know, kind of like New York City today. And they're all expelled when Israel gets created. So it's sort of hard to think of them as settler colonialists if they wound up there from other parts of, if Middle Eastern Jews from other Middle Eastern countries wound up in Israel because they're expelled from their countries where they've been for a long time. And so for those reasons, I do reject that narrative. But I think that's the explanation of it, which I think you're asking for, is how do they see it as a settler colonialist country? Well, they see it as a kind of overstay of British imperialism there, I think would be the answer.
Okay. I hear that. like yeah. you, it's hard for me, but I hear that. That is helpful. I appreciate it. I hope that listeners, you guys appreciate that too. Thanks for being our leftist, Ken.
Yeah. that being said, I do want to just say, I think that these calls for a ceasefire that so much of the American left is calling for right now, I do actually find it, you know, not just wrong, but really deeply offensive that they don't call for release of the hostages first, right?
Yes.
It would be such a simple thing, right? I mean, by now half the hostages are probably dead, but if there's still 50 or 60 living hostages, you know, why not say there should be a ceasefire in exchange for the release of all those hostages? It just seems to me like a complete moral non-starter to ask for a ceasefire without asking for release of those hostages.
I mean, I'm glad you say that, because I didn't want to come off too strong on this, but I can't imagine. I put myself in that. So one of my children are being held, right? I'm not going to either want to stop shooting personally at those people or have other people stop shooting at them until my kids are back. And I'm not willing to talk about it until my kids are back, right? Like just hard stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not like, while you're holding my kids in your basement, mm-hmm. I'm going to shoot at you. Like, I just can't understand.
Yeah, no, me neither. That's where you and I are 100% aligned on that. I think it's outrageous. I think it's immoral to say that. And I would also add to that that there's some narratives you sometimes hear now, and I'll say from the left mainly, where they say, well, you know, you have to realize the Palestinians themselves are oppressed people. They're oppressed by Hamas. Hamas is the terrorists, and Hamas is an authoritarian dictatorship, and the Palestinian people don't deserve to suffer the brunt of all that because they're being first oppressed by Hamas and then bombed by the Israelis. But I think that can't be right either, because if you remember when we had that 1 week of hostage swaps, and there was actually the pause for that week, the very reason that the pause came to an end on the day that it did, even though it could have kept being continued for another week or two if there'd been further hostage exchanges, is because we got to the point where Hamas, they'd already given up. You know, I mean, they said they were keeping some soldiers, but there were plenty of other civilians too. But they'd got to the point where all the civilians that were being held hostage no longer were being held hostage by Hamas, right? So it's not just Hamas that's holding all these hostages. In fact, Hamas couldn't even get their hands on the other civilian hostages, because it's just other Palestinian terrorists in Gaza who weren't even affiliated with Hamas, who were just keeping all these other hostages. And I think that fact just really belies this kind of notion that there's some great separation between Hamas and the Gaza people, and that the Gaza people don't want the same things that Hamas wants, or that Hamas is somehow not an authentic representation of the people. I mean, if that was true, then there wouldn't be so many other hostages being held by people where Hamas doesn't even have any access to those hostages or those people who are holding them.
Yeah, I agree. It just baffles me a little bit on that front, that there seems to be a downplay of all of those peoples who were trapped, what happened to them, and continued to be held prisoner. They are civilians who are being held, right? We're not talking about, these aren't, I mean, there are a few potentially kind of military-esque, but even they wouldn't exactly apply, because they were captured during a period of non-war. Ergo, you're still not holding them as prisoners of war. So, I mean, even calling them military is, in terms of international law, not true, because you weren't engaged in a conflict. It would be like us snatching up a bunch of soldiers out of China and then attacking and saying, oh yeah, by the way, now we're holding your soldiers as soldiers. That's not how that works.
I'm so glad you pointed that out, because there's even a paradox in Hamas's position. I mean, if they're claiming that they have the right to hold these soldiers, then they're claiming that they are in fact at war. But if they're claiming that they are in fact at war, then how are they complaining about being bombed?
Well, yeah. Ken, on that happy Christmas note, But I will say, you know, I think sometimes we always think of, you know, of Christmas or things as being times of happiness. But I will say there are a variety of holidays that happen in this time of year. And if you are like me, I wish you a very Merry Christmas. But if you are one of many other amazing traditions, I want to wish you the holiday that you choose. And further, I want to make sure that regardless of your belief system, Mike has asked me to give you this very special message. And he asks that all people unite in celebrating the secular and religious holiday of Festivus on December 23rd. He did. He texted me that we need. and so for those of you who have already put up your Festivus polls in anticipation of the 23rd, good for you. Ken, I hope that you have a good holiday as well.
Yep, you too, Trey. And happy Festivus. That's from Seinfeld, right?
Is that yes, what I'm saying? The airing of grievances.
Yes.
Now, I will remind us all one more time that our weekend show will resume on Mike 30 with Mike and Jay closing out 2023. So again, this is our last show of 2023, Ken, for our weekend shows at least. But we still do have our supporter exclusive show that will come out next week, as it always does in the midweek. And we'd love for you to join us on that. What Ken and I have been doing for these, so for our, I guess, our technical last show of the year, what we've been doing is we've been going through the U.S. Constitution. We've gone all the way through the text of the Constitution in 2023, and we've now been into the amendments. And so we're going to be dealing with the freedom of press this week, and we'd love for you to be a part of the freedom of press. And to be able to be a part of that, you're going to have to be a supporter, because that is one of our supporters' items, is our supporters' midweek show. As a matter of fact, the podcast, it doesn't work without supporters. And so when you become a supporter, we want to make sure that you get cool stuff for being a part of our family. And so that means things like the extra show. It means things like getting this show and other shows ad-free, which is really cool, by the way. It also means you get opportunities for us to take a look at things on Discord. There's all kinds of really cool things. And if you want to find all of those things out, all you've got to do is head to patreon.com/politicsguys. Patreon.com/politicsguys. And especially this holiday season, I would suggest, I know you're already, you know, spending your gifts, maybe give the gift of the Politics Guys to somebody that you know and love by heading to patreon.com/politicsguys. I know other people have done this for me. Matter of fact, I was in line for the turkey trot the other day, and I was giving my name to get my info. And the person next was like, "You're on the podcast." And I was like, "Yeah." And they said, "You know, I'm gifting that to a couple of my family members for Christmas." I was like, "That's really cool." So again, just a little thought for you. You might want to head to patreon.com/politicsguys and make that your last minute holiday gift. There's other ways, of course, to support the show as well. You can do that at Venmo, where we're at Politics Guys. You can also support the show through PayPal. All of those are in our support links and in our show notes, as well as by heading right there to politicsguys.com/support. Now, if you'd like to get that midweek show, but you're not in a position financially to do it, hey, get that. All you got to do is shoot an email. If you'd reach out to Mike at politicsguys.com, we can get you set up and you'll get a fun little link. Now, whether you're a supporter or not, it is a really big deal when you rate and subscribe. I mean, think the last time. Do you scroll down 100 places to get to the next podcast of your choice? My guess is no. And the way that those algorithms work is by rating and by sharing these episodes, we go higher and higher. So it's really free. If every week you could just go in there, rate us, rank us. That's amazing. And then don't forget, you can always do that on social media as well. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or anything else you'd like to share with us, you can always reach out to mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and X, where you'll find the links in the show notes. A special holiday thanks to the executive producers of The Politics Guys, who are Bruce Johnson, Will Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new show, well, in a couple of weeks. I hope you'll join us then.